offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the privilege of coming to you as always live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam, the very place where Swami sat and energized this place from when he visited us, when he inaugurated the studio, and it's always a pleasure to be talking to you live from here. Today is a very significant day in India. I'm sure some of you must have tuned into the program from the Mandir. Today happens to be the Independence Day of India, so it's a holiday. So hopefully many of you are free enough to listen to this program from the comfort of your homes. Apart from being emotionally attached to the country and the idea of patriotism, that's always there. I think whichever country you belong to, Swami would say that you should be proud of your country, you're proud of your heritage. But talking about the independence struggle itself, it's a very, very significant movement, especially in the context of the program that we are going through, because many of those stalwarts who were leaders of the independence struggle of India were deeply inspired by the Bhagavad Gita. We all know that Mahatma Gandhi was someone who always went back to the Bhagavad Gita for his inspiration. He would quote the Bhagavad Gita. There is also the story of how I think it was Professor Venkatraman who would often narrate about Rajagopalachari, who was again a freedom fighter who was very deeply inspired by the Bhagavad Gita, when he was called in a case of sedition, if I'm not wrong. The judge who was supposed to pronounce this judgment against him quoted from the Bhagavad Gita and said that, you know, here is in front of me someone who is my inspiration, and my hands tremble when I have to write the order. Quoting those verses from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and Rajagopalachari was very impressed, and he said, I'm very happy that my learned judge is well versed in the Bhagavad Gita. And, you know, all of them, in fact, one of the books I refer to for this program, a lot of people have asked me, is a book written by a great freedom fighter, Bal Gangadhar Tilak. Right? Swami has also spoken about him extensively. It's, in fact, one of the most scholarly books written on the Bhagavad Gita in the recent history, if I could put it that way. There's a book called Gita Rahasya, where he's written about it very, very scholarly. The way he quotes with ease from the various scriptures of the Bharatiya tradition is truly mind-boggling. And the reason I'm saying this is, these were all karma yogis. When we look at us, when we go through Bhagavad Gita, and when we wonder, can somebody really live like a karma yogi? These were all people who were driven by this beautiful concept of karma yoga, which the Bhagavad Gita spoke about. Right? In fact, Bal Gangadhar Tilak's work, The Gita Rahasyam, completely addresses the Bhagavad Gita, or gives a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita based on this concept of karma yoga and how we must do what is our lot without expecting anything in return. And this thought and this great philosophy is what inspired this freedom movement itself. And that's what makes the independence struggle of India very unique in a sense, because it was driven by a spiritual urge. A lot of these people thought that, you know, if we were to take this country back to her spiritual roots, she must first have political freedom. Many of them approached the idea of independence itself like that, and that's why I think it's very, very significant. Not merely because we are Indians and we are proud of being Indians. We are talking of a movement which was inspired by Bhagavad Gita, the very text that we are going through. And I think it's wonderful that we are getting to have a session on the Bhagavad Gita on the very day that we celebrate this Indian independence movement. With that, we'll proceed towards what we are in the midst of studying. We are in the third chapter, and I was thinking that we might complete the third chapter as of today. But let's see how it goes. There are four verses before we can call it the end of third chapter, but we'll see how it goes. We'll try not to hurry it up. We'll even otherwise, maybe we can complete it next week, and I'll also give a summary of the third chapter like how I did for the second chapter. But as always, we'll start with a short summary of what we covered last week. Last week we covered four shlokas, shloka number 36, 37, 38 and 39. In verse number 36, Arjuna asks a question, and that's how a new section of the third chapter begins, where Arjuna asks, what makes a person sin and what makes one sin even when one doesn't want to, right? In the previous few verses before that, Krishna had spoken about Swadharma, right? And Arjuna is not a bad man in that sense. He's not a sinner. But he has come across situations where doing the right thing was not spontaneous or was a little difficult, right? That is why he's asking this very nuanced question. He's asking why people do mistakes. Why people do mistakes even when they don't wish to, right? It's a very important question that he's asking. And Krishna answers that the desire that leads to anger, the desire that arises from rajoguna, is the cause. And we had seen the subtle meaning of this answer that Krishna has given. The desire to follow the right path is a sattvic desire, and Krishna is saying that a rajasic desire impedes the sattvic desire, right? That's essentially the answer that Krishna gives. And thus he explains the problem that Arjuna is facing and the question that Arjuna is asking as one of balancing the gunas or managing the gunas, and that's what we're going to be talking extensively today about, right? In verse number 38, Krishna goes on to give three beautiful analogies where he describes how desire covers intelligence or intellect. He says, like the smoke covers the fire, dust covers the mirror, and the amnion or the womb covers the fetus. And we saw how these are different types of desires which require varying levels of patience and perseverance, where some require a lot of patience and time, just like the child or fetus in the womb. There's nothing that one can literally do to get the child out. One only has to have the patience and perseverance, right? So it's a varying level of patience and perseverance requiring desires is what Krishna is referring to. In the 39th verse, Krishna more or less summarizes all of this, in this entire sentiment that he's talking about, and says that this is how desire is a constant enemy of the wise. And we also saw how Shankaracharya beautifully explains why Krishna is saying that it is a constant enemy of the wise. Because he says that when it comes to an unwise person, desire seems like a friend up front. But eventually it shows its true colors and they find that, oh, I should not have followed this desire. I've come to ruin because of this. But whereas in the case of the wise, the desire is always known and it is always acknowledged as an enemy. So the wise or those who are striving to be wise should always beware of desires before and after indulging in it, is what Krishna was saying when he says that for the wise, the desires are an eternal enemy. So those were the verses that we covered last week, as I said, 36 to 39. We'll proceed with the next verse, which is verse number 40. As always, we'll listen to it in the clear rendition by Brother Shyam. After that, I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail about that verse.
Indriyani mano buddhihi asyadhishthanamuchyate yetair vimohayatyesha jnanamavritya dehinam.
The senses, the mind, and the intellect are said to be its seat. Through these, it deludes the embodied by veiling his wisdom. So, to repeat the context of where this discussion is coming from, I think it's important to backtrack a little bit so that we have the continuity of the discourse, because we're doing it over weeks. And there's a week break, so I think we might miss the continuity. So just to step back a little bit, Krishna had said that self-control is of no use because there is this prakriti or nature which governs each person, right? That was something that he had said a few verses back. And then he also gave the solution. He said the prakriti makes its appearance in the conscious mind as raga and dvesha, or likes and dislikes. One must ensure that one doesn't become a slave to them, is what he had said. And we had seen that likes and dislikes are not necessarily bad, because they will be a part of our mind till we have a mind, literally, right? We constantly make choices based on our likes and dislikes. and most of which are pretty harmless. But Krishna says that one must not become a slave to them. And that's the most important sentiment that Krishna has tried to convey in that. One must not become a slave to them. And what does that mean, or how does one ensure that? Krishna goes on to say that follow your swadharma. And we had an extensive discussion on what is swadharma. We'll not go into that again. But then Arjuna reiterates, but that is the whole problem. What stops me from following my swadharma? What makes me commit sins even when I don't want to, right? That's what we had just gone through in the summary. And Krishna had said that your desires are your enemy. Now, we had discussed in detail about what we refer to as desires, right? Desires are nothing but raga and dvesha. What we refer to as raga dvesha is nothing but a different terminology for desires. Because when I say that I desire this object, or I have a desire to become rich, it is nothing but I like this object and I don't like the idea of not having it. I like to be rich, I don't like to be poor. So it is again the same raga and dvesha as the problem that we're talking about. And after all the explanation, Krishna is coming back to the same problem, and he's saying that maybe I'll explain it to you this way to just tell you how confusing it is if you look at it in a superficial manner. Let's say the Indian cricket team is trying to win the World Cup, and let's say every time the team loses to Australia in the final, a kid comes and asks me, what should India do to win the World Cup? And I say to him, oh, we only have to defeat the Australians. And the kid asks me, why are we not able to defeat Australia even if we want to? And I say, because Australia defeats us. It seems like going around the same thing, right? I hope I'm conveying what I'm trying to tell. Krishna is saying that, you know, you have to overcome desires. Why am I not able to overcome desires? He says, because desires are defeating you. So it appears like it is not a helpful solution or an explanation that Krishna is giving. But the whole hint is in this aspect that Krishna refers to. Krishna had said that kama and krodha that arises from rajoguna are the enemies to anyani, right? The desire born of rajoguna is the problem. Now that is the hint that Krishna is dropping. Now this desire troubles us in two ways. When Krishna says, don't be slaves to your desires, follow your swadharma, there are two points here that are equally important. And in fact, if you look at it, Arjuna is struggling with both of them. And honestly speaking, we all struggle with both of these issues. One is, what is my swadharma? What really is my dharma that I'm supposed to follow, right? That is the first thing. And the other is, what stops me from performing my swadharma? So there are two aspects. One is ascertaining what is swadharma, and the other is following that swadharma. So when Krishna says follow swadharma, there are two instructions here. First, know clearly what you're supposed to do. And the next is be strong-willed enough to do it. And the enemy in both these endeavors is desires born of rajas. Kama or desires distort our idea of what is swadharma, and Arjuna is very much in that predicament, right? And after knowing what is swadharma, still we must have the will to do it. And I think, as I had mentioned before, when we were referring to Swami's Dharma Vahini and we were discussing about swadharma, swadharma is nothing but following the voice of the conscience, right? And the conscience is nothing but the voice of God. If you look at Arjuna's predicament or Arjuna's fortune, if I could put it that way, Arjuna's fortune is that the conscience is actually standing before him in this embodied form of Krishna, right? So Arjuna's question was, why am I hesitating even after knowing clearly what I have to do? Because what Krishna is telling him is pretty much the voice of the conscience, the voice of the Atma. But still Arjuna is hesitating, and that is why he's asking this question. I know what is right because you have told me, you have clearly told me what is my swadharma, but still I am hesitating, and what is making me hesitate? And the answer to that is, again, kama or desires that are born out of rajoguna. So when we deal with this desire, one, we can see clearly what we must do, and the next is, we will have the will to follow what we are supposed to do. So that is why dealing with these desires, Krishna says, is doubly beneficial, right? One is it clears your ability to see what is right and what is wrong, and it also gives you the willpower to do what is right. So the question, where do we begin, right? This much is clear. It's the background work. So where do we really begin? How to deal with this desire that is rajasic? Krishna had said that this is the greatest enemy, right? So to battle an enemy, you must first know where the enemy is and what is the enemy's strategy, isn't it? So that is what Krishna explains in this particular verse that we heard. He says, Indriyani mano buddhihi asya adishtanam uchyate. Indriyani, the senses, mano, the mind. For now, I think this word, manaha, for now, for the clarity's sake, I will call it the thinking or the contemplating mind. I'll explain why that is so. So he says, Indriyani, the senses, manaha, the mind, buddhihi, the intellect, and he goes on to say, asya adhishtanam uchyate. These three, it is said to be its place or residing place. Adhishtanam literally means inhabiting place. So where is the enemy? Krishna says it resides in the senses, in the contemplating or thinking mind, and the intellect. What is the strategy of this desire, the enemy? Eshaha, this, because the reference is to the desires. So eshaha, these desires, etaihi, through these, jnanam avritya, having enveloped the wisdom, vimohayati, deludes, dehinam, the embodied person. So the place of the enemy is the senses, mind and intellect, and the strategy is also through these three. That is, it operates through them and it deludes. Before we try to understand this shloka better, let us go back briefly to the idea of the three gunas. Because Krishna is specifically referring to desires that are born of rajoguna as the problem, right? As I said, that is the hint, clear hint that Krishna is dropping. We know that there are three gunas, tamas, rajas and sattva. And it is true that we are trying to move towards what we refer to as shuddha sattva or pure sattva, or that is the state of the Atman or the self, as the Veda, as Upanishads describe it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that tamas and rajas is bad per se. Tamas and rajas also have their specific roles to play, but they should not go off balance, right? That's one thing that Swami would often say, that we have to maintain the balance of these three gunas. So they should not go off balance, or one should not dominate over our personality. Now, what is the influence of the three gunas on the mind? Sattva is the pure nature, the nature that is taking us towards the goal. And whenever we say pure in the Vedantic context, or from the point of view of what Krishna is trying to tell, or what Swami's message is, purity is everything that takes you closer to God. Impurity is everything that takes you away from God. So sattva is the pure nature, the nature that is taking us towards the goal. Tamas is the nature that keeps us dull and lethargic and being demotivated, right? And rajas is the active nature where there is passion and dynamism. Right in the beginning, in the second chapter, we had come across this point that Swami had made in the Gita Vahini, right? When Arjuna drops his bow, slumps to the chair and he says, I won't fight. Krishna speaks to him very, very harshly. In fact, he uses words which pierce Arjuna's heart like sharp arrows, right? And literally, Krishna instigates Arjuna to become angry. And Swami had said that Arjuna in his despondency had slipped into tamas. And what Krishna wanted him to do was actually to raise to sattva and follow his dharma. But no sense or explanation can be given to a person who is in tamas. So he first had to be risen to rajas. He had to be raised to the level of rajas before he is made to, or before he is given the explanation of the pure idea, the sattvic idea, right? And then the discourse of the Gita could be given. And that is what Krishna was doing. He was instigating him, making him angry, so that he will come to the state of rajas. And the same Krishna is saying that anger and desire that is born out of rajas is the problem, right? So the clear idea is rajas also has a role, right? Our ambitions comes from rajas. The idea of karma itself initially comes from the quality of rajas. But we very easily lose that balance, and rajas becomes an overpowering emotion, right? And that becomes the real problem. The best example is that of a horse-driven chariot. And of course, that analogy is from the Kathopanishad, and that analogy itself can explain the shloka very clearly. We'll come to that eventually. But look at the example of a horse-driven chariot. What enables the chariot to move? The horses that pull it, right? But if the horses become so aggressive that they go out of control, the same horses begin to drag the chariot as they will, and the chariot can't be taken to where it is meant to go, isn't it? Same is the case with rajas. It is very important to a certain extent, but when it overpowers, as Krishna had said, it covers the wisdom and deludes the individual. The order in which Krishna has mentioned the abode of the enemies, right, in this particular shloka, he says, Indriyani Mano Buddhihi. That order is also not without significance. The senses, the mind, the thinking or contemplating mind, and the buddhi, right? These three things, the senses, whenever I'm saying manaha or mind in this particular context, I'm only referring to the contemplating mind and not mind in general, because when maybe I'll make that clarification now. When you say mind has four aspects, right? So as Swami would say, mana, chitta, ahankara, and buddhi. All of these constitute the mind. But what we refer to as manaha or mind is actually the mind with which we operate on a day-to-day basis. And that's the thinking mind, the working mind. To be able to talk on this program, I need the mind. For you to be able to listen to what I'm saying, you need the mind, right? It's a mind that is required for our day-to-day activity. But when we talk about the mind as a whole, it contains all of these things. The buddhi also is contained in the mind. But when we say manas, which is translated as mind in English, but it refers to this working mind or contemplating mind. And the reason why I'm repeating the word contemplating mind is, as we saw, Krishna had clearly explained that desire comes because of the mind constantly thinking of a certain object of the senses. Dhyayate vishayan pumsaha. When the mind constantly contemplates on some particular object, that leads to attachment, that leads to desire, that leads to anger and so on and so forth, right? So that is why when Krishna says here, Indriyani Mano Buddhihi, we are referring to the senses, the manas aspect of mind, which means the thinking or the working or the contemplating mind, and coin it as it suits you, as it gives you the clear understanding. And then the buddhi, which is nothing but the discriminating mind, right? So he says the senses, the contemplating mind, and the discriminating mind, if that makes it clear for you. So in the analogy of the chariot, the horses are the senses. The mind is the reins that are attached to the horses and are held by the charioteer. And who is the charioteer himself? It is the buddhi, or the discrimination aspect of the mind. So the problem starts with the horses, isn't it? Or the first one, or the first in the line of fire are the senses. What is the nature of this rajoguna that we are talking about? Well, there's another way of explaining the influence of the three gunas on the mind. Maybe I'll mention that and we'll get a better idea of what is rajoguna. Tamas is when the mind is completely dull and switched off, right? Say when you're completely disinterested, or maybe even completely knocked off, completely unconscious. The sattvic mind is a mind with a one-pointed focus on the goal. And a mind that is under the influence of rajas is a distracted mind, or a mind whose attention is scattered and is multi-pointed, right? So as Swami would say, I think he says this in his Vahini, the Dhyana Vahini. I hope my reference is right. Swami says no-pointedness, multi-pointedness, and one-pointedness. No-pointedness is a sign, or is the nature of tamas, where you're so dull, you're not interested in anything, or you're completely intoxicated or completely unconscious, right? That's the state of no-pointedness. Swami says that is of no use and that is dangerous. The second is multi-pointedness, where you're in activity, your senses are being dragged on all sides. That is the rajas aspect of the mind. And all of us are trying to raise ourselves to the sattvic state of mind, where it is one-pointedness and the mind is pointed at the right thing, right? Let me add that also, as Swami would say, one-pointed mind and the mind that is turned inward, right? That completes the nature of a sattvic mind. So from no-pointedness to multi-pointedness, from multi-pointedness to one-pointedness is what we are trying to achieve. So a rajasic mind is certainly better than a tamasic mind. But from that multi-pointedness of the rajasic mind, we must go towards the one-pointedness of the sattvic mind. And that's what we are talking about when it comes to a nature of a jnani or a wise man, right? So where does this distraction come from? Where do these distractions come from, right? Because they are multiple in number. Let's say I'm sitting and trying to study. How do I get distracted? There are primarily two ways by which I can get distracted. Either something else catches my attention by coming before me, or there is a loud music playing in the next room, or somebody is watching TV in the next room and that loud sound is coming in where I'm studying, or there is a nice smell of aroma of something nice being cooked in the kitchen. My mother is cooking dinner and that aroma is coming into my room and I'm starting to think about food, or a nice aroma is coming from the neighboring kitchen, right? So these are all the distractions for when I'm trying to sit and concentrate and study. These are all the ways in which distractions come to me, right? And these are all coming through the senses. So this is one type of distraction which comes, which is the distraction that come through my senses, either something happening in front of my eyes, something I'm hearing, something I'm smelling, right? Or somebody who's sitting next to me and probably physically touching me and disturbing me, right? So all of these are ways by which the mind can be distracted. There is another way by which the mind can be distracted. Let's say when I'm trying to study, my mind starts thinking of something that I saw in TV yesterday, or probably a discussion or a gossip that I had with my friends sometime earlier. Or my mind starts wondering about, I wonder what's for dinner today, right? So these are all things which are not directly coming through the senses at that moment. These are distractions that are coming from the mind. But if you look at them keenly, you will realize that these are again distractions that have come through the senses, right? So in both cases, the starting trouble is with the sense organs. So either they get dragged themselves, or they take in something and the mind keeps contemplating on it. And that is how our focus goes from trying to be one-pointed to becoming multi-pointed. So how is it they reside in the intellect or the buddhi? It is understandable that they distract the senses and then they enter the mind and the mind starts thinking about all of these things and that's why we are not able to concentrate. But how is it that they start residing in the intellect, in the buddhi, as Krishna had said? Something that happens to most of us, what we refer to as convenient philosophy, right? Philosophy and any kind of intelligent thinking comes from the buddhi. Once our senses and mind get deeply interested in something, our intelligence is only used to justify our craving and justify all the actions that we take to fulfill those cravings, isn't it? How many times it happens to us? And that's in fact one of the problems of being very intelligent and not being focused on the right thing. Your intelligence will be used to justify the wrongs that you do, right? And it is not only to cheat others, we end up cheating ourselves, right? Many times there will be a mental dialogue which happens within us where we are trying to justify something that we have done, where probably the conscience is saying that it is wrong, but the mental dialogue is like, that is where the intelligence itself gets deluded. So the intelligence is certainly a very, very powerful tool, but it depends on who wields it, right? And that is how the intelligence, Krishna says, gets deluded. And as Swami would say, the animals are always drawn towards objects of the senses, right? That's how they have been pre-planned or pre-programmed. if man is also drawn the same way, then in the case of man, what happens is he starts using his superior intelligence to start satisfying these cravings, and he starts satisfying these cravings in a very sophisticated manner. We have ended up inventing tastier food, our homes have become more comfortable and luxurious, and the way we seek pleasure has become more advanced compared to the animals, right? So with our superior intelligence, we have managed to enhance this pleasure-seeking nature of ours, right? And this is how, when Krishna says the desires delude the senses or drag the senses, the desire deludes the mind, and the desire eventually deludes even the intellect, which is supposed to be a very powerful tool in the spiritual journey, right? In fact, Swami would say that at least animals have reason and season. But when it comes to man, we have, through our intelligence, through our scientific development, we have managed to insulate ourselves from the changes of nature and changes of reason and season, right? In many ways, we are able to protect ourselves from bad climate to a great extent. We are able to protect ourselves from the vagaries of nature to a great extent compared to animals. Of course, even now when the fury of nature unleashes its full potency, we have nothing to do against it. But to a great extent, compared to the animals that live in the wild, we have managed to insulate ourselves from all of these vagaries, right? So in all this, Swami says that now when it comes to pleasure seeking in man, there is no reason, there is no season, nothing seems to impede him, right? And that is how, even though the intellect or the buddhi is supposed to be a very powerful tool in the hands of a spiritual aspirant, the desires can delude the same intellect too when they're allowed to enter through the senses, allowed to take a grip over the mind through the contemplation of the mind on these objects. Eventually, you know, it is like the senses, or I'm sorry, the intellect follows suit. So what are we supposed to do? That is what Krishna explains in the next verse. And as we said, we will again go back to that beautiful allegory of the Kathopanishad, the analogy where the mind, the intellect is described to as a horse-driven chariot. But before that, we'll listen to the next verse, verse number 41. Then I'll give you the meaning for that and we'll discuss about what Krishna says there.
Tasmatvamindriyanyadau niyamya bharatarshabha papmanam prajahihyenam jnana vijnana nashanam.
Therefore, O Arjuna, controlling the senses first, do kill this sinful thing, the destroyer of knowledge and wisdom. Krishna is explaining to Arjuna in a language that he will relate to, right? He called Kama and Krodha as enemies, then he explained where they hide and what is their strategy. Now Krishna is explaining what should be Arjuna's strategy to deal with them. He says, Tasmat, therefore, Bharatarshabha, O best of Bharatas, O Arjuna, Adav, in the beginning, or at the very outset, Indriyani Niyamya, control your senses. So as the analogy of the chariot goes, when the horses become agitated, they run and pull the reins, right? And what are the reins? The reins are the mind or the manas. And the charioteer now loses control, and maybe now he goes along with where the chariots drag the chariot, and maybe he just has enough control to maneuver the chariot a little bit, and he's literally taking it where the horses want it to go, but he's just probably, you know, maintaining it and ensuring that it doesn't fall off, right? So Swami says, instead, the charioteer or buddhi is supposed to take instructions from the master of the chariot. Who's the master of the chariot? The self or the atma is the master of the chariot. And then the buddhi or the charioteer is supposed to control the horses using the manas as reins and use the horses to take the chariot to the right place, right? So this is how it is ideally supposed to be. But when the horses get agitated, they pull the manas the Manas pulls the charioteer and the charioteer loses control. And this entire chariot, which is referred to as the human body, goes to where the senses drag it rather than where the self is guiding it to. As Krishna said in a few verses ago, he says, Indriyasya indriyasya arthe raga dveshau vyavasthithau. Each sense organ has its likes and dislikes with relation to the sense objects, right? That's what Krishna had said a couple of verses ago. That is not wrong per se. That is in fact a natural function of the senses. And this is not me saying, this is of course again Swami's words, because as Swami would say, if you talk about the sense of taste, it is made in such a way that when you eat something and you find it disagreeable, its taste is disagreeable, the mouth spits it out, right? And invariably what is disagreeable in taste is actually food that is spoiled or rotten, which when eaten is going to upset the stomach and lead you to a sickness, right? So Swami says the tongue has been given that function to see whether what you're eating is of a good taste or not, because what is of good taste invariably becomes good for the body, right? So you spit out something which is not agreeable to the tongue. Similarly, when there is bright light which is shined on the face, Swami says automatically the eyes close to protect itself. Same is the case when, say, I pick up something hot. You know, the moment it is very hot, the hand immediately drops it, because holding it for any longer will lead to me burning my skin, right? That is why Swami would say the senses are referred to as matraha, or measuring instruments. Constantly they are measuring what is agreeable to this body or what is good to this body. So this sort of raga and dvesha is inbuilt into the senses, and in fact it is quite useful to us and we cannot call them as being dangerous. But at the same time, when they get agitated, they go out of control. So one of the best ways to deal with this enemy desire is, Swami says, start with the control of the senses before they get stirred and agitated, right? So we are talking about two states within this problem of senses interacting with sense objects themselves. You're talking about a passive sense, or passive, the senses when they are passive and the senses when they are agitated. It's easier to control the senses when they are passive compared to controlling them when they are agitated, right? Another way of looking at them is to see the senses as windows or doors through which we let things enter into our mind, right? In fact, we have already discussed this analogy earlier, where we spoke of discrimination as a lamp in the middle of the house whose flame starts wavering because of the breeze that comes in from the windows and doors. So we close the windows and doors and open them only when it is needed, right? So Krishna is saying here in this particular verse, the desire is the enemy. He reiterates this in the second line. He says, Prajahihi, you must certainly kill yenam, this papmanam, sinful, jnana vijnana nashanam, the destroyer of knowledge and realization, right? That's what he tells in this particular verse we had gone through. Again, I think Krishna is speaking in the language of warfare to the warrior Arjuna. He is referring to desire as a sinner, right? Now, Arjuna is a kshatriya and he is supposed to punish those that cause havoc in society, right? In the past, if there was a trouble with dacoits in the city, if there were highway robbers who were troubling the citizens, or even in the case where there were wild animals coming into villages, they would often go to the king and the king would send one of his warriors, right? And he was supposed to go and punish those or capture those who were sinning against the people. And that was part of their duty, right? So that is why Krishna is speaking to Arjuna in that manner by saying that, look, this is an enemy, right? And he says, he's speaking about an internal enemy, but the way he's describing it is pretty much like how Arjuna is used to thinking about enemies or people who are troubling citizens who have to be captured. Now, if you talk about a thief, you talk about a dacoit, they are only taking away things which are objects that are belonging to people. But we are talking about a thief who is a Jnana Vijnana Nashanam. Somebody who has the ability to take away your greatest wealth, right? There is no thief who can steal your knowledge from you. There is no thief who can steal your wisdom and learning from you, right? And that's why they would say that knowledge is the greatest wisdom, because it increases when shared. A thief cannot steal it from you, and you know, a flood cannot wash it away. That's why there is a beautiful Subhashita which says that's the greatness of this wealth of knowledge. But now Krishna is telling, but there is one thief who can take away even this knowledge, even this learning, and that thief is desire. And he's telling to this warrior Arjuna, look Arjuna, you've captured many dacoits, you've captured many enemies of the state, but here is somebody who's taking away something which is so precious. He's papmanam, he's sinful, and he's jnana vijnana nashanam, a destroyer of knowledge and wisdom. You certainly have to go after him, right? But nevertheless, Krishna is speaking about an internal enemy, and very beautifully he's teaching a strategy to deal with it. If you really look at it in the larger sense, this is not necessarily going to be useful for Arjuna at the current moment. The strategy that Krishna is talking about is a lifelong strategy, right? And it is more useful to people like you and me who are reading it now than to Arjuna. Arjuna probably has been, many times that happens, right? You know, when you're in Swami's fold, when you've gone through SSC, or when you've been a student of Swami, staying in Swami's hostels, we would have done certain things without knowing why we are doing it, and we would have even benefited from it. But at a later stage, when we come to know that, you know, this is how it works, we are glad that, you know, we followed some of these disciplines early in life and we benefited from it. So Arjuna more or less is in that state. Many of the things that Krishna is explaining to him, Arjuna has followed, right? And as we will go through this, we will see that the Pandavas have been following these things. Mother Kunti has brought them up in a manner that where they have followed some of these virtues very, very well from the young age. So in that sense, what Krishna is telling is not directly applicable to Arjuna, the warrior who's not ready to fight and wants to take sannyas. But through Arjuna, this is a great wisdom, a practical wisdom that Krishna is giving to all of us, right? So Krishna is asking Arjuna, can you bring in disciplining of the senses before the senses start getting agitated, right? Before they fill the mind with thoughts that distract, and eventually with thoughts that delude the intelligence. It becomes all the more complicated when all of this happens. When it gets into the mind, when it starts deluding the intelligence, it becomes all the more difficult. So Krishna is saying, you may have maximum control when it comes to the senses that operate through the body compared to the problems of the mind, right? So if we were to go back to Krishna's solution, the essence of what Krishna has said was, you have a sattvic impulse, but the rajasic impulse covers it or challenges it. So we must ensure that we somehow tip this balance towards sattva, right? That is the whole idea of what Krishna is conveying here. Can we tip this balance and make our nature more sattvic? And everything that enters through any of the senses is called food, right? That's a very, very important definition that Swami gives. When I think there was a beautiful conversation between Swami and Dr. Hislop, which we had covered during the afternoon satsang, where when Hislop asks about thoughts, and he asks, where does these distracting thoughts come from? Swami immediately says it comes from food, right? And then, of course, goes on to explain that everything that enters the body and the mind, especially the mind, through the senses, is also food, right? So first and foremost, Krishna is saying, purify what enters through the senses to ensure that the mind is left with pure thoughts to contemplate. The mind has two sources, right? We'll again come to that in detail, and we'll be discussing this again and again. The mind has thoughts. The thoughts in the mind have two sources. One is what enters through the senses, and the other what comes from the subconscious mind, right? In the first, when you talk about what enters through the senses, he says, that is at our disposal, right? Krishna doesn't mention this particular point, but I think it's a very important point that Swami has spoken many times before. See, when we are talking about the senses, we say that we have a far amount of control over what comes through the senses. There are these three entities that we're talking about: the senses engaging, the mind thinking, and the intellect being able to discriminate. And the desire affects all three in a progressive level. And it is progressively difficult to deal with the desires when they attack the senses, the desires when they've attacked the mind, and the desires when they've deluded the intellect. So Krishna's solution is deal with them when they are interacting with the senses itself. So one of the ways is to ensure that you take in only the right things, right? And for that, a tool which Swami has given, which of course Krishna has not mentioned here, is to be in satsang, right? When we ensure that we are in the company of people who will speak and discuss the right thing, the good things, automatically we reduce the chances of consuming rajasic content and getting it into our mind, right? But of course, it is not as simple as I'm making it sound. But at the same time, it is not as difficult that we should not try it at all. Why is it difficult? Because even when it comes to filtering through the senses, our inner nature or swabhava or prakriti, that will come into play, right? Now, if you give me some free time, let's say I want to watch something or I want to read something, what I choose to watch or choose to read will also be defined by my inner nature, right? That is what defines what I will take interest in. So when we speak of our nature, we are referring to the subconscious mind, and we have almost zero access to the subconscious mind. We do not have any kind of direct access to the subconscious mind. And then Krishna says that the subconscious mind expresses itself in the conscious mind, or literally it bubbles up in the conscious mind as desires, right? And of course these desires cloud our reason. So we have a subconscious mind which we do not have access to, and the subconscious mind leads to desires in the conscious mind, and that is where we are trying to deal with, right? We can battle with these thoughts, we can counter them with good thoughts, right? That's one more a tool or one more technique which Swami always speaks about, but it is still not as easy. But when we talk of actions, we certainly have much, much more control over our actions compared to our thoughts. And since that is the first wall of defense, we must learn to defend ourselves from the enemy there itself, right? So if I could put it this way, let us say I'm addicted to smoking, right? And I'm trying to quit that habit. It is going to take a very, very long time for me to give up thinking about smoking. But I don't have to necessarily pick up a cigarette every time the thought occurs, isn't it? I can try to divert my mind when the thought occurs, and that in a way, you know, I will have to keep doing, but I cannot always stop a thought, but I can certainly stop an action before I do it. It is difficult because that is what is the problem with habit. It's a compulsive disorder, right? It makes you do something. But nevertheless, I certainly can stop an action much, much more easily than I can stop a thought. In fact, I hardly can stop a thought. At least I am not in that situation where I can stop thinking about something, right? It just comes up of its own. But an action or my speech, I can always have control over, right? So the point I'm saying is it is difficult. It is not that it is easy to, especially when you're talking about addictions and habits such as that, it is not easy to control your actions completely, but it is easier than controlling the thought. But the most important thing is over a period of time, when I don't pick up the cigarette or when I avoid this particular action that I'm trying to give up, the thought of doing it also will go away, or that thought will start becoming weaker. And this is, again, not something which is rocket science, not something that we all don't know. This is our everyday experience with our habits and addictions and other problems that we have, right? So I'll repeat that again, because this is one of the most important things in this particular section of the third chapter. You have the subconscious mind where there is the nature. The nature makes his presence felt in the conscious mind in the form of likes and dislikes, what we refer to as desires. And those desires eventually find expression through our actions. And the more we give expression to certain desires through our actions, Swami says that the nature starts getting strengthened in the subconscious mind. So what Krishna is telling here is, he says, Adhav Indriyani Niyamya. At the very outset itself, start by controlling the senses. Right? That's what he said. Adhav Indriyani Niyamya. In the beginning itself, control the senses. What happens when you do that? Eventually, the thought starts getting weakened in the mind. But you might get the thought to do the action, but the more you stop yourself from doing the action, eventually the mind starts getting purified of that, which means you're using your senses to battle the enemy at the front of the senses itself. And just like how through our actions, the conscious mind itself starts getting purified, Swami says eventually, but it'll take a long time, the subconscious mind also will start getting purified, right? Which means the thoughts that arise in the mind will itself start becoming pure thoughts. Eventually, when the swabhava or the nature itself starts becoming sattvic, the thoughts that bubble up in the mind will also start becoming sattvic over a period of time. And when that happens, the mind itself becomes a tool to freedom. Right? What we were talking about, the mind with desires as being an enemy, now the mind without those desires, or the mind with those sattvic desires, right? That's what we had spoken about before. We're talking about sattvic impulses and rajasic impulses, or sattvic desires and rajasic desires. When the spontaneous desires that arise in the mind become increasingly sattvic, the mind starts becoming a tool in this path, right? The same mind with which had rajasic desires becomes an enemy, now with sattvic impulses becomes a friend or a tool in this journey. And that is why Swami says, Maneva Manishanam Karanam Bandha Moksha Yoho. It's the same mind. But this is the process. You cannot try to change your nature, right? If my nature is to have a certain impulse, I cannot directly change it. And there is no point in me telling, oh, I'm such a bad person. Oh, I have such bad thoughts. Oh, I have such, you know, bad inclination. That is not going to take us anywhere, right? So Swami says, start with where you have control. There are thoughts in the mind, counter them with good thoughts, right? That's what Swami had told even Dr. Hislop. You start thinking more of God, you start converting your desires into desires for God, automatically the mind gets purified. And when it comes to the senses, start looking at them as windows through which your mind gets impulses. The mind is right in the middle. It gets its thoughts from the subconscious. We do not have control over that. But it also gets impulses and thoughts from the senses. There, Swami says, we have more control. Can you start with that by controlling your senses? Right? So the bottom line of the answer to what Arjuna was asking, when he says, what is it that stops me from doing something even after I know that it is wrong? When he asked that question, the idea is he didn't want to know what it is. He basically wanted to know how to deal with it, right? That's what we had spoken about. He was asking, how to deal with that? And then Krishna says, eventually the bottom line of all that is, deal with that by purifying whatever enters your mind through the senses, right? It all starts there. And as an extension, as I said, as Swami always tells, it begins with satsanga or good company. When you keep yourself in the midst of people who have such sattvic thoughts, with whom you tend to discuss sattvic things, who tend to take you towards God. Finally, that's what Swami says. Who is good company? Who is a good friend? Who is a good companion? Swami says, anyone who takes you closer towards the goal, anyone who takes you closer to God is a good friend. Anyone who takes you away from God is a bad friend. Right? So eventually keeping yourself in the company of people who tend to speak the right things, tend to make you speak the right things, you know, will eventually ensure that the right things enter the mind through the senses, and eventually the mind gets purified, and over a long period of time, the swabhava itself starts getting purified, right? And that is why this all starts with, as Swami said, the two important things, patience and perseverance. And patience and perseverance comes when you have faith in this technique that I teach, right? That's what Krishna had told a couple of verses back. So all of this, there are two important points. One is the recognition that we are not the mind, right? Though I have not mentioned this enough already, this is one of the bottom line of whatever we are discussing. We are looking at the mind, we are looking at the intellect, we are looking at the body and the senses as a distinct entity, and we are talking about how to deal with them, right? So the bottom line is the recognition that the mind is only a tool, I am not the mind. And the second is the hierarchy that we spoke about, the body, the senses, the mind, the intellect, and who we really are, which is separate from all of this. There is a certain hierarchy to this, and that is the bottom line, and that is how Krishna ends this particular chapter. As I said, we don't have enough time to do that. There are two more shlokas where Krishna speaks about this very hierarchy and this very idea that I am separate from the mind being the basis of this entire beautiful description that Krishna has given, right? And this, in fact, is the answer to all the questions that we often ask. You know, why am I not able to stick to my sadhana? Why am I not able to stick to good habits? As children, why am I not able to wake up early in the morning and study? I want to do it, but I'm not able to do it. As youngsters, I want to be regular in my exercise, I'm not able to do it. Or as spiritual aspirants, I want to do my sadhana every morning, I'm not able to do it. Or I want to go for my seva weekly, I want to go for my bhajans weekly. Over a period of time, I lose interest in it. The answer to all of that is in this portion of the third chapter, where Krishna beautifully explains, you know, where it is easier to tackle this desire. And most often we miss that part, and then we wonder about how to tackle it in the mind. It's so much more difficult to tackle it in the mind, and it is close to impossible to tackle it when it goes into the subconscious, right? When it becomes a part of our nature. So Krishna says, start tackling it at the very doorstep, at the senses themselves. Then you have enough enemies inside to deal with. Why do you want to keep filling it with more and more forces from outside? So I think that is the pretty much the essence of what Krishna had said in this particular few verses that we covered today and the verses that we covered last week. So I think we'll conclude with that, dear listeners. Thank you for joining me again this week. I'll join you all again next week. As I said, we'll complete the third chapter. Maybe we'll begin the summary of the third chapter too, if time permits, and we'll see how it goes. If the summary needs another episode or another half episode, we'll take it that way. But I think you'll agree with me that to summarize the third chapter is important before we go ahead to the fourth chapter. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I do hope you'll all join me again next week, 7:30 p.m., for continuing this pilgrimage of the Gita series. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram. Thank you.
to Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.